A listener production.
This is From Zero, where I get the real stories behind some of Australia's best business successes. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of LuxuryEscapes.com, financial journalist, author, and angel investor. With my best mate from school, we co-founded Luxury Escapes, and the business has grown to turn over almost $500 million annually without raising a dollar of outside capital. People ask me all the time, how do we start the business? And now I want to turn the tables. In this episode, I speak with Graham Turner from Top Deck, Flight Centre and Spices Retreats.
Running Top Deck in your 20s, it is a stressful job running old double-decker buses across Europe and Asia and having breakdowns and accidents and that sort of thing. So, you know, running a travel agency, it's a doddle. You know, after what we've done with Top Deck, running shops all over the place is nothing.
Graham Turner, or Screw as he's universally known, is one of Australia's greatest founders. He grew up on an apple orchard in regional Queensland, where he went to a one-teacher school. And when he was 15, Screw went to a boarding school in Toowoomba. And he said compared to helping out on the farm, boarding school was a breeze. But from an early age, it became clear that Screw wasn't going to take over the family farm. But he didn't think he'd go into business necessarily either.
It was a family affair. Dad used to not only use me for labour and all that sort of thing, but he used to talk about things that he was doing and, you know, the small entrepreneurial things he was doing. So you were brought up all the time to think about it as a business. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, how to the sort of things that cost you money and the sort of things where you could do a bit better. We were mainly apples, peaches, plums and pears. Yeah, being post-war, this was mainly the 50s and 60s. You know, the fruit prices generally were pretty good. There was a reasonable demand. So, yeah, we were involved. As a family, you were involved, and you did talk a fair bit about how the business was going and that. But I don't think there was a huge amount of talking about entrepreneurship, and it certainly, you know, it wasn't the most exciting life, I can assure you. It was one of those things that, you know, you had the radio. Later on we got TV, but that was just basically I'd left home then. So it was listening to the radio at night, playing cards with the neighbours, but we saw very few people most of the time. So it was a pretty quiet life all around. That's why I sort of determined at the time that I didn't think I really wanted to be a farmer.
Like many people in travel, you didn't study. I don't think there even wasn't back then a tourism course. You actually became a veterinary surgeon. You were 23, 24, and you moved to England to become a vet and to work as a vet. Was that always sort of the – you always wanted to live overseas, work overseas? Was that sort of long-term?
Yeah, well, my first job basically from about November, December after graduation till about July when a group of us had already from college had decided to go to the Munich Olympics in 1972. So we went over there and then travelled around Europe for a while in a combi van, the typical thing Australians did then, before going back to the UK and I worked as a locum for the next, I don't know, 6, 8, 12 months and before we started Top Deck.
That's a great segue. So I'd love to talk about your first business, which is Top Deck. So you're in England, your early 20s, and I think your mate Jeff Lomas and you decided to buy a double-decker bus and start a tour business, which I guess now you look in hindsight, it seems obvious, but it sounds outrageous almost to buy a bus and start a business, and you guys were a couple of vets. How did you get the idea?
Well, it's an interesting question. We actually, travelling around Europe, in the combis, we saw the odd, you know, I think one or two double-decker buses, English double-deckers fitted out with beds and kitchen and this sort of thing. So I was back working as a vet in Yorkshire and there was this old airfield, old World War II airfield that was just covered in secondhand double-decker buses, you know, and I had a vet student with me at the time. We'd just been to see a horse, I remember. I can't remember what was wrong with the horse, but we went and had a look at it, and there was one bus that it had actually been fitted out by someone. It had beds, bunk beds, and the full fit out of kitchen. And just after that, I'd gone to the beer fest, and Jeff Lomas was there, and over a few steins, I convinced him that he should come in with me, and we should all, 50-50, buy the bus. And he went travelling. I went up to Leeds. I think the village was called Sherburn in Elmet, and bought the bus and drove it back to our flat in Fulham, which was the neighbours weren't very happy about us parking double-decker bus in the street in Fulham, but that's what happened.
So I want to go back to the bus for a second. So I presume buses aren't that cheap. Even this is obviously not a brand new bus, but how much did the bus cost you guys?
This one cost us about £650. It was called Argus. The next one was Tuft, and I think I'd say probably £1,000 for it. It was fitted out as well. But then the next three, Grunt was the second one, which was I think about £300 or £400, but it wasn't fitted out. Tuft was fitted out, and it was about £1,000. But then we bought three, probably after about 12 months. We'd been going about 12 months, and the three of them unfitted out was £750, £250 each. So, you know, not ridiculously expensive.
Even so, you were running a tour business, not a retail agent. So you obviously had significant capital, or some sort of capital costs. Was that all from your savings, or where did you guys get the money to even afford any of these buses?
Yeah, we certainly didn't have any bank loans, and we didn't have a lot of capital. I think we, I think £650 for the first bus, but then we were taking about £100 a person for the trip. The first trip we ran in November 73 was a Spain, Portugal, Moroccan. We charged about £100, and I think we ended up with about 18 passengers on it. So we had about £1,800. Food kitty was £3.50 a week, so that was separate. And then when we came back, I think the trip cost us, something like £800 or £900 a run. So we had that excess over that. We invested in new buses, and that's how we did it. We just kept buying new buses when we had the cash. And, as you can imagine, banks wouldn't loan us money, and we didn't have much money. I think, I don't know, between the three of us, Bill James, a passenger on the first trip, came in. He was a teacher, and he bought the bus and fitted it out. That was his sort of contribution to the company. So we didn't have much money. We might have all had about total capital of about £1,200 to £1,500 each. So, money was in fairly short supply. But and in the 79-80, we pretty much nearly ran out of cash. I think we had 60 or 70 buses by that stage, and we had trouble paying our bills, but that was an important lesson as well.
Not long after you started the business, I think Jeff had to come back to Australia for personal reasons, and as you said, Bill, who became a big part of the story and was a passenger, joined the business. Were you guys 50-50 partners at the time, or was Jeff still have a shareholding? How did you guys split ownership back then?
Jeff and I were 50-50. When he left, Bill and I were 50-50. Then Mick Carroll came in. He was a relatively early passenger, and he came in a little later. And I think I was 50% and they were both 25. That was for some 2 or 3 years until I came home in basically 82. And I sold half of my half to some of our managers. We had a number of senior managers, if you like, that ran, one person ran the workshop, one ran the marketing, and someone ran the ski tours and that sort of thing. So there were about three or four of them that I basically gifted it to them. And so we each had 25% and they had 25%, and we actually sold out to them in 1986.
By the late 1970s and early 1980s, Topdeck had around 70 buses in their fleet, and their revenue was substantial, more than £15 million every year. And if you're wondering, that's equal to a couple of hundred million dollars in today's language. But around this time, Screw and his wife, Jude, decided to move back to Australia to raise their son, Matt. It was here that Screw would start his very first travel agency.
The business itself, we did tend to get a lot of our bookings at that stage out of Australia, even then. You know, quite a lot out of the UK because a lot of Australians and Kiwis and South Africans lived and Canadians lived in London. And that was quite a big part of the early days, you know, the early 70s. But later on, by 76, 77, I'd set up offices in London, in most capitals of Australia, top deck booking offices, and we were repping travel agents and that sort of thing. So by the early 80s, we were getting quite a bit of our business out of Australia by then. And, yeah, we decided, Jude and I decided to come home largely because Matt was due or born in June 1981, and we wanted, I suppose, to live in Australia to bring him up there. And that was where we were doing a lot of our booking. So it was sort of a natural place. Mick Carroll took over the operations, and he was very capable. He's still actually working in tour operations, actually, believe it or not. He's the same age as me. And Bill helped him as well from about, I think, for about two or three years while I was back in Australia and starting as well as running the top deck offices, you know, starting up Flight Centre as well. So that sort of worked pretty well between the three of us.
So you've come back to Brisbane and you started a new business. I think you're obviously still running top deck. And then I think there's a bloke called Dave Tomkin who maybe tell us a bit about Dave. So he was involved in, I guess, what was bucket shops back then. And you guys went into some sort of partnership with Dave. What was the sort of genesis of, I guess, Flight Centre version 1.0?
Yeah, I knew Dave. Dave was a young guy in London. He probably was in 1980. He was probably, I don't know, 25. And we knew him. He worked for a guy, Bevan Aldridge, who was famous for the Walkabout Club in those days in London. And he had a shop called the Flight Shop, I think it was, in Kensington Church Street. Got to know Dave. We used to go running together and that sort of thing. And he was obviously a pretty good operator, good salesperson. He wanted to come home at some stage. So I think he was from Adelaide originally. And he decided to come to Sydney to do some sort of flight centre. And it was eventually called Sydney Flight Centre, opened in the Prudential Arcade in Sydney in 1982, I think March 1982. And I convinced him to come in on a 50-50 partnership with Top Deck Travel, and which he did. And we had a signed agreement, which Dave often talks about, which just was a sheet of paper with Dave Tonkin and Top Deck agree to set up Sydney Flight Centre 50-50. Dave does all the work and Top Deck take half the profits, I think was the agreement. And Dave, after about a year, he'd made nearly $100,000 profit, believe it or not, in that first year. He came over to London when I was over there because I used to travel regularly to London and said, look, I want to buy you out. Dave, great guy, but he was a bit of a loner. You know, he liked doing things himself, not being part of a big company. So that's what he did. And so he bought us out for, I don't know, it might have been $100,000. Then we used that money to set up Brisbane Flight Centre and a couple of other shops over the next year or so. Jeff Harris then came in and set up the Flight Shop. I think it was the Flight Shop in Hardware Lane in Melbourne too. So, you know, it just started coming together then. And we generally brought in someone who was going to be generally a 25 to 30% partner in the shop, and they contributed to that. And that's how we grew Flight Centre in the early days.
Australia to London flight, what did it cost before you guys started selling it? And then how much did you save customers? So if someone bought for you versus from Amex or ANZ or whoever they were, like how much were you genuinely sort of disrupting and saving the customer in the end?
We also had London Flight Centre at the time. I think we opened London Flight Centre in about when we still owned Top Deck, as part of Top Deck in 82, 83. So we obviously could buy tickets out of London as well. But Bear in mind, we've got an index called the Turner Index, because, and what it does is it shows you the average salary, amount of the average salary that it took from 1949 to about 2014 in terms of London to Sydney in return. And believe it or not, it was, I think it was 18 months salary in 1949, and it got down in 2015 to something like 2 weeks. But the actual prices didn't really change a lot. You know, the prices generally were around that $1,500 to $2,000. And after COVID, I suspect they'll be pretty similar as well. So that's one of the challenges for travel agencies, isn't it?
These days, it's hard to imagine the Australian travel industry without Flight Centre. But in the early 1980s, amazingly, the discount airfare market didn't even exist. Skrew and his partners, Bill James and Jeff Harris, totally disrupted the industry, and they were profitable almost from day one. By the late 1980s, Flight Centre had grown to around 30 locations. When the business was floated on the ASX in 1995, they had more than 300 stores and were already expanding into Canada, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. But what makes Skrew's story even more remarkable is that while Flight Centre was expanding, in the early days, it was actually illegal to discount airfares. But through some good luck, they managed to avoid ever getting into any serious trouble.
It is probably surprising we didn't get caught, although some travel agents did. I remember at the time, agents did get caught, charged and fined. It was only for a couple of years, maybe 2 years, 3 years, that it was illegal. So it probably became legal in about 84. And it was interesting because the first judge we had in the Singapore Airlines case with the ACCC, you may not remember that, but the judge says, you know, it's funny, here I am hearing a case where a travel agent is being accused of somehow of forcing an airline to discount airfare tickets. And I actually prosecuted in 1982, I prosecuted travel agents for discounting them. He saw the irony of it even then. But we never got caught, and the law did change fairly not long after we started. So probably you could say we're pretty lucky there.
In 1995, you guys listed Flighties on the ASX, and you actually weren't that big a business. I think you're doing maybe $1 billion TTV back then, which, as it turns out, would be pretty small compared to what you grew to. But what led that decision to list, and how monumental do you think it was for the business in terms of your subsequent growth?
It's an interesting question because, yeah, there's a pros and cons of listing. It's relatively expensive. There's a lot of you get put under the microscope. But we were quite big on having staff be part of the ownership of our organisation. We looked at a whole range of different schemes. We did have a individual shop scheme called Business Ownership Scheme, which was based on a debenture system. And the debenture system basically meant that, you know, if you own 20% of a shop and it made $100,000 profit, well, you'd get 20% of the profit each year return on that debenture. The industry in the late 80s weren't really happy with what they could see us as bucket shops coming up and taking their business away from them. And that's when the TCF, the Travel Compensation Fund, was set up. So at that stage, we had 30 or 40 separate companies, a different company for every shop that had another shareholding in, which basically all did. So that's when we set up that debenture scheme. But the debenture scheme replaced the individual shop ownership, but we wanted to give people, particularly some of our more senior people, the chance to have an ownership. We had a good look at it, and really listing an IPO was the only reasonably simple and tradable way that we saw we could do it. So that was a primary reason at the time. And when we floated, we had, I think we floated at 95 cents to the market and 85 cents to staff. And I think we had quite a few staff that managed to buy 50,000 shares. And I think we ended up with about staff owning about 6 or 7% of the company.
Let me just fast forward a couple of years. We'll get to the pandemic in a second. Before we had the pandemic, you guys have to deal with another pretty big deal, which was the global financial crisis. I think your share, credit mark could be slightly off here. I think your share price dropped from 20 to maybe $4 or something at the time, somewhat irrationally now. I think you guys were sort of deep into discussions with private equity to potentially do a management buyout. I'm not sure, it has been reported, but not hugely. So how close did you guys come to buying the business back in what was sort of 2009, 2010, in what would have been an incredible deal, but obviously didn't happen in the end?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the share price got to, but it was pretty low. I think it might have dipped to $4, but I think the deal we were looking at was probably about $7. And it was with private equity group. I won't mention their names. So I don't know whether it was public. But it was quite interesting because we were quite gung-ho at that stage. We thought that we were grossly undervalued, and it was an opportunity to, with private equity, to take the company back private. I'd never had a lot of problems with being public, but it was just a good opportunity, and we were all fairly keen. We had a board at the time. Unfortunately for us, two of the board disagreed with us and voted against. Well, made it a lot harder for us to do. And I think one investor who represented quite a few investors, Lazard, you probably would have heard of them, vote on behalf of their investor, voted against it. So we didn't get the required 75%. I think we got 65% voting for it. So the combination of the, if you could say, a slightly hostile board and Lazard's, meant it didn't happen, and we didn't do it. I've got no regrets. I think, it could have been interesting, could have been a different turn of events for us, but I think we got over it pretty quickly. We, as you can imagine, we got a new board fairly quickly, but that's all right. There's no hard feelings there.
Most people probably know Flight Centre as being the biggest Main Street travel agent in the country, selling leisure travel to millions of Australians. But in the early 2000s, they did their next big pivot to Flight Centre Corporate, which is a multi-billion dollar business in its own right. After Flight Centre had expanded its leisure operations into Canada, South Africa and the UK, an employee called Heather Gilbert decided to set up the very first Flight Centre Corporate under Jeff Harris in Melbourne. The business grew slowly but surely in the beginning, and by 2003, they started acquiring other smaller travel businesses around Australia, as well as the UK and the US, which they rolled into the corporate side of Flight Centre. And that's when their corporate sales really started to take off. And while leisure travel has been hit really hard by the pandemic, Flight Centre's corporate business continues to go from strength to strength, winning billions of dollars of new business since 2020. But few industries were quite as affected by COVID as the travel sector. COVID wasn't the first challenge that Skroo ever faced in business, but no one was quite prepared for what this one would turn into.
I think January, February, March, we've seen this before. It could be disruptive. It could be a bit like 9/11 or SARS-1, but the reality didn't get hit home until I came back from London for a short trip in, I think it was March the 12th, 2020, and I think the next weekend, ScoMo shut the borders, Trump had shut the Atlantic flights from Europe. We really realised then that we were in trouble. And I know I got back about the same time as Mel Waters-Ryan, who was our CEO of Leisure, and we immediately got into a global, our global MDs and my team, which we call the Task Force. Chris Galanti's the global CEO. He's based in the UK of corporate as well. So between there's probably about 20 people, and I have to hand it to Mel. She organised a lot of this. Straight away, we had two meetings a day, two crisis meetings a day, depending on where you were in the world, to basically to start slashing costs. And you know, our costs, as you can imagine, were around that $230 million a month. And our income from April, May went to basically zero. So, you know, our sales were about $2 billion a month, went to, you know, maybe $50 million a month or something like that for a few months. So we just had to find every you know, cut our costs. And as you know, stand down a lot of people, let a lot of shops go, negotiate with landlords and everyone else that would listen. So there was a very hectic period for probably 3 months. For the first couple of 6 weeks, we're probably working 7 days a week, having meetings twice a day with the global people to just try to stabilize things and get everything under control, which happened probably after the first 10 weeks, 10 or 12 weeks, and then gradually working out what money we needed and how we would find our way out of this. So it was sort of getting into hibernation and survival, and then working out how you're going to thrive in the you know, in the longer term. So and we've come back now. This is only 20 months, as you know, and I think we're back to about 25 to, you know, somewhere between 25 and 30% of pre-COVID TTV. So we've still got a long way to go.
So I want to take you back to those really difficult weeks, March and April. How worried were you that the business wouldn't survive, and how did that affect you emotionally, knowing this is such a brilliant business, to potentially no fault of your own, an existential virus that had nothing to do with our country initially anyway, could destroy what was such a incredible business a month earlier?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, put it this way. I was probably so involved with my guys in terms of working to minimise our costs and maximise our liquidity that we didn't have too much time for reflection. But I know it was a very worrying time. You know, there was no guarantee of survival at that stage. You know, if the capital markets had turned on us or wouldn't have supported us, well, you know, not only us, of course, but a lot of other businesses, not only in travel, but imagine if that coincided with the GFC, where money became very tight. It would have been a road smash, not only for us, but for a lot of industry. So we were probably fortunate, I think, that during that time there seemed to be quite a lot of liquidity in the you know, the Western world, at least anyway. So generally, even though we managed to raise plenty of cash, and believe it or not, that ability to raise cash for businesses like ours, which we don't actually need now, and hopefully we won't need any more over the next 4 or 5 years, it was crucial. So, you know, probably you could put it down to luck and timing, nothing to do with us, but that's the luck of the game, I guess.
Yeah, as tough as it was for travel, and it has been for travel over the last, as we both know, for 18 months, there's some sectors have done really well. And obviously, e-commerce has done really well. Another sector that possibly surprisingly has done well is the bike sector, and potentially due to good luck or great management, Flight Centre and your son Matt own, I think, Australia's largest bike retailer called 99 Bikes. I think you've got 50 stores nationally and maybe some internationally. How has that business gone over the last 18 months?
Yeah, well, Matt actually set it up with one shop 14 years ago. 2 years later, Flight Centre bought a small but important wholesale business, basically wholesaling Merida bikes and other products. And at that stage, he had about 5 or 6 shops. So we combined them two into a wholesale retail business, which wasn't too different to what Flight Centres looked like. So they were just hitting their straps. So I think probably by 2019, they had about 50 shops. They were looking at New Zealand. The wholesale business was going quite well. And then in 2020, with COVID, they made about 18 or 19 million. But this last year, they've now got about 70 shops, including about 8 in New Zealand. And they did about 350 million in sales, but about 54 million in profit. So, you know, it's become quite substantial. And yeah, a lot of that was due to the COVID demand, but a lot of it, they took big punts on buying a lot of stock up at the right time. So where a lot of bike shops just didn't have enough stock. And even though they didn't have enough stock, they were much better stocked than most of the people. So, and now this stock is still in short supply, but they've consistently over-ordered, and so far it's paid off for them. And, there's still plenty of products that you just can't get hold of in Australia for love nor money, but it'll come back. Matt, I know Matt thinks it'll take a couple of years for it to really come back, but just in terms of when he started, he did take quite a bit of his systems and training, a few of his people from Flight Centre, a couple of key people, but you know, generally for the last probably 9 years, they've basically done their own thing. We've had very little. We have one person who sits on the board, and that's basically our input at the moment.
I think one of your great strengths as a leader, as a CEO, has just been your ability to constantly evolve. And I guess when you stay at the top for 40 years, you sort of always need that. But you've been you're a tour operator, you started a discount flight seller, and you became a sort of global giant, and now you're vertical. Flight Centre owns DMCs and hotel operators, and obviously is corporate. How do you think you've evolved as a leader since 1972 when you were buying buses to 2021 when you're managing a $24 billion business? How have you had to change your leadership style, how you've delegated? How have you grown over that period?
Oh, that's a really tough one. I mean, look, I think everyone in life changes a reasonable amount. Certainly I know running Top Deck in your 20s, that was a stressful time, mainly not just because of who you are or what you're doing, but it is a stressful job running old double-decker buses across Europe and Asia and having breakdowns and accidents and that sort of thing. So, you know, running a travel agency, as I said to Bill and Jeff, it's a doddle. You know, after what we've done with Top Deck, running shops all over the place is nothing. But, you know, it does teach you to calm down a bit. I was much calmer after the Top Deck experience, partly because, you know, running travel agencies, it's more an 8-to-6 sort of job, although, you know, obviously weekends are far more important now. But with a growing family and all that sort of thing, I think it was just a reasonably calm occupation to take hold of. And I think probably over time I've just become a bit more easygoing in terms of how to take business and that. And my reaction to the COVID restrictions and all that probably would have been different 30 or 40 years ago, but I think you're in a different organisational way, and I just know in travel particularly there are a lot of players that don't have the capability of raising money, and they must be, a lot of them I know are sort of either desperate or having to run on the smell of an oily rag, which is, you know, means very hard to protect your key assets in a business like that. I mean, but my other thing, Adam, is business is important in some ways. It is important. I mean, it's important to people who work here. It's important for people whose family depends on the income that work or investment here provides. But in the end, it's not life and death. Businesses do come and go, and I'd certainly like our business to be a long-lasting business, multi-generational. You've probably heard of The Infinite Game by Simon Sinek. I think he encapsulates that quite well, that it's not about a stray return to the investors only or making a lot of money. It is about surviving and thriving, which I think is one of his terms that he uses quite a lot. And we certainly try to take that on, that as a business now, whether it's Flight Centre or the Pedal Group or other things, that it is long-term. It is about a long-term multi-generational business. And by multi-generational, I mean, you know, that leaders and managers and people come and go, but the business survives the generations, if you like, and thrives. It's no use. Surviving is okay when you're in a COVID crisis, but in the end, you need to thrive as well.
You've, aside from Flighties and obviously 99 Bikes, you and your wife, Jude, have created one of Australia's most incredible brands and Spices Retreats, which is a premium luxury regional hotel brand, essentially. How important has Spices been for both you and Jude in being obviously a different business that you guys own completely and have created from scratch? How much focus do you put on Spices and how important is that to you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we've been involved in that now for 22 years or something, I think, since the first property. And the Spices brand's been around about 10 or 12 years, I think. And I can honestly say that I don't have too much to do with it. We're quite involved in wildlife protection and habitat protection on the properties where some of the retreats are. And generally, Jude has managed that, but she generally has professional managers. Dave Asif is her CEO at the moment, and he's been CEO for 10 years, but she still has quite an influence on it. But she's quite quick to point out that I don't really have a lot of say in it. I quite like going there and staying at some of the places, and probably more than her, because for her it's, you know, there's a bit of element of work. For me, it's just fun. So, I must admit, along with her, quite proud of that. I think we don't get everything right, but they are a great collection of retreats. And the Scenic Rim Trail, which is fairly recent, it's a 5 to 7 day walk in luxury eco lodges. You know, it is stunning, and it goes through some of Queensland's most stunning scenery, and that a lot of people don't even know exists. So, those are things. It's great, but I can't take too much credit for it.
And you've obviously been. You've been at the top of your game for 40 years. Do you have an end game? Do you ever see yourself slowing down, or you've got another 20 years left in you, think?
Look, I think I'm sure it's like you, or maybe it's not like you, but I certainly want to see our organisation out of this COVID issue or problem, which I think will be the next 3 or 4 years. And, you know, you can never say never, but I can't imagine wanting to retire, but at some stage I probably won't be given any choice. And I think the main thing is if you're physically and mentally fit, and as you get older, both those things can become a problem. You don't have a choice, but I'd like to say another 5 or 10 years, but I don't know what the board thinks about that.
And that was Graham Turner from Flight Centre. And while he may have had 40 years at the helm, Skroo certainly isn't slowing down. Just before we recorded this podcast, Skroo played in a winning game of touch rugby for the Flight Centre team. Our producer is Lindsay Green. Our audio producer is Darcy Thompson. For more episodes, search From Zero Podcast with me, Adam Schwab.
Listener.